listening to Harris Smith Radio. Hey there, I'm your host, Wayne McPhail. In this episode, I get the lowdown on one of the most misunderstood and maligned crops in North America, hemp. It's a delicious breakfast topping. It's a construction material. It's great for clothing and plastics. Stop. You're all right. I speak with Hemp Ambassador Marie Eisenman about the fiber of the future. Next up, food writer and chef Signe Langford tells us all about delicious and dangerous chestnuts and how to weaponize them. By the way, if you want to read Harrismith magazine instead of listen to it, you can subscribe to the print version online at harrismithmag.com. And you can find Harrismith magazine on selected newsstands across Canada. But for now, settle in for the next half hour of Harrismith Radio. Marie Eisenman is a hemp ambassador. She and her colleagues evangelize a sorely mistreated and marginalized crop, hemp. While hemp has for centuries been a valued crop in Asia and elsewhere on the planet, its relationship to marijuana has led to North Americans having a complicated relationship with the fast-growing, low-maintenance, and non-psychotropic plant. That's too bad because, as Marie explains, the prohibitions placed on its cultivation have meant that North Americans have lost decades we could have used developing ecologically friendly industries that make use of the versatile hemp seeds, flowers, and fibers. That's starting to change, due in no small part to Marie herself. Here's our chat.
I'm Marie Eisenman, and I'm the co-founder and director of Ambassadors. Ambassadors is a nonprofit organization dedicated to the promotion of industrial hemp.
Thanks very much for joining us, Marie. I wanted to start off by asking a pretty simple question, but I think one that's caused some confusion for you and Ambassadors is, what's the difference between marijuana and hemp?
Oh, there is a big difference. In fact, it's the same plant at the beginning, but it's a botanical family that includes on one side species of marijuana and on the other side species of industrial hemp. They're like cousins.
And the hemp that's grown in Canada and elsewhere, it's deliberately bred to have a low THC level, right?
Yeah, it's really regulated by Health Canada, and it's very checked. So if you want to, if someone, a farmer, wants to grow hemp, he has or she has to choose among a list that is very precise of species that are approved for this kind of cultivation. And there are tests. And if you buy hemp seed at your health food store, you're sure you're not going to get stoned.
Right. And is there CBD oil in hemp or not?
CBD is, so it's cannabidiol. It's a molecule that is content in hemp, but in hemp flowers. Okay. So it's not in the hemp seeds. For example, if someone eats hemp seeds for breakfast, they will not get CBD. So there are different levels of CBD in industrial hemp. And there is also CBD in marijuana. It's good to be known. There are species of hemp with very low levels of CBD. For example, most of the hemp that is cultivated now in Canada is for hemp seeds or sometimes for also hemp fibers, and they have low levels of CBD. But now producers are trying to develop varieties of hemp, industrial hemp, with high level of CBD because it's a molecule that is very attractive at the moment in the medical area.
So I wanted to touch on that at the beginning, the distinction between hemp and marijuana, because I wanted to go back historically. That distinction has been not made so clearly, and it's really interesting, especially in the U.S., looking at the history of hemp growing from the founding fathers on. It's been sort of a love-hate relationship with hemp because of marijuana in the U.S., right?
Exactly. Well, first, we have to start at the beginning, and the beginning of history of hemp dates back to 10,000 years ago. It's one of the oldest domesticated plants in humanity. So it has been here for millennia from China, and then it migrated to Europe. And then in the 17th century, it was brought to America. And it's very interesting to learn that in the first colonies, for example, Virginia, farmers by the law were obliged, had to grow hemp back at this time because it was such a useful crop, so necessary because it was used for ropes and clothing and everything, and construction material too. So it was compulsory to grow hemp at some times in the history. So the situation changed in the U.S. at the end of the 19th century when hemp lost ground, facing new alternatives that were easier to process industrially. There was some hope because there were new machinery that was about to be developed in 1936. This machine was available, but it made a big competition to the paper industry, to the synthetical fiber industry that was developing at the moment. And very powerful lobbies managed to have hemp put in the same bag than marijuana, and both of them were forbidden by the law in 1937 in the state and then in the world.
And then the war came and that changed again, right?
Yeah, that's a trick of the history. So it was banned. It was something very illegal. And then a couple of years later, because of the war, because of the need of ropes and silk and all this, the American government made propaganda. And there is a film about this that we can find on YouTube showing that they were pushing farmers to grow hemp again for the war effort. And then again, it was banned in the States, 8 years. The cultivation of hemp has been legalized last year only in December in the United States. So it's a love and hate relation. And it's a pity that we lost so many years of development of hemp because of this prohibition, because there are so many products that can be made with hemp, and thinking that the farmers and the industry have lost the ability to transform it, and they have to learn again how to process hemp, how to make it into plastic and into hempcrete and all this. It's sad that it has been lost.
I want to stay with history for a little bit because I find it so interesting, especially during the war years. It was almost like hemp was the Rosie the Riveter of materials, in the sense that it was called into play for, like, women were called into play to work in the industry during the war, and then afterwards it flipped again and they weren't wanted anymore. The women weren't wanted and the hemp wasn't wanted, right? So it's a kind of an interesting flip. And then after that, it's that whole period that you talked about, that 80-year period, is kind of the reefer madness kind of period in the U.S., right, that started that. But in Europe, there was, if I recall, there was prohibition, but France and other countries in Europe just decided enough's enough, and back in the 70s started growing hemp again. Is that right?
Yes. In Europe, people decided that it was enough and hemp should be back because it has so many advantages. It's an ecological crop. It's very quickly renewable. It's very versatile. So they decided to go back to cultivation, and most of it was for fibers and herd to use as a construction material, because the hemp is great to do hempcrete or to do insulation. So it was the main use in Europe, not really for seeds, but more for the stalk.
And it was always popular in Asia, right?
Asia and China, where hemp is said to be from. Cultivation has not really stopped there. In Japan, too, because hemp has a special status. China has remained the first producer in the world, and is still the first before Canada. Canada was in the second position until last year, and probably this year it will get to the third position, because with legalization in the States in last December, U.S. will become the second largest producer in the world.
So let's talk about the cultivation for a bit, now that it's being more widespread in Europe and in the United States and Canada and elsewhere. You know, when we think about the history of the United States and in terms of growing stuff for fiber, we think about cotton. And cotton, as you know, is a very, very water and fertilizer and pesticide intense crop. Hemp isn't that, is it?
Correct. Hemp is such a great crop for a very low impact on environment. It doesn't require pesticides, so it's a big point. It doesn't require irrigation except in the very hot climate. It just requires a little fertilizer, which can be put in organically.
So it really seems like we've lost years to cultivate a crop that seems to be, in terms of being ecologically friendly, you know, it seems like a perfect kind of crop. And it just seems, as I read the history of this, it's such a shame that so many decades have gone by for no good reason that it couldn't be grown.
It's really sad when you think about it now that this plant has disappeared for decades, because now with the environmental crisis that we face, we think, wow, if hemp has not disappeared for 8 years, we could have so many materials made out of hemp, like plastic, like concrete, like body care products, like medication, like clothing. So we can use the stalk, we can use the seeds, we can use the flowers and even the leaves. What is good is that we need this plant for the future, and it's here now, and we are back to it, and this cultivation is re-emerging, so it really brings hopes for the future.
So tell me a little bit about the industrial uses of hemp, apart from rope. You said for construction. How is it used in construction?
In construction, it's the inside part of the stalk is chopped and is mixed with lime to make hempcrete. So it's a very antique, very old technique that has been used for millennia, and it makes very breathable walls and very safe for people. So it's one of the uses. In Quebec, for example, there are two companies that build houses with hempcrete, and it can also be constructed, self-constructed. So if someone wants to start a self-constructed house, hemp is a very good material. And before, this material had to be imported from Europe, as I told you, because here hemp was especially cultivated for seeds, but now it starts to be available for from Canada. That's one of the things, hempcrete. The other material that can be made with hemp is insulation. Insulation panels, they are alternative to the regular panels used for insulation. And the first company doing this in North America is based in Quebec. They started 2 years ago, and they have different, it's a kind of mattress. So they have different kind of material that can be used to insulate a house or a van, for example, the camper or any kind of building.
So much better than asbestos coming out of Quebec, right?
Yep.
So tell me a little bit about some of the other uses. One of the things I was interested in reading about was the role that hemp has played historically in paper and how it can still be used for paper now. Right?
One of the uses of fibers is paper. So the long, because the stalk of hemp has two parts, long fibers on the outside and curd inside, more cross fibers. So these long fibers are good for fine papers, like papers, Bible papers, this kind of very refined papers. But the inside can be used also to make cardboard or more gross paper. Hemp has 25% more cellulose than wood, and it doesn't require chemicals to be processed into papers. So it's a very, compared to a forest that will take 20, 25, 30 years to grow, it grows in only 3 to 4 months, and it produces a lot of cellulose, a lot of fibers that will make very ecological papers and cardboard. So it's one of the uses. Hemp is also very well known in Canada for being, and elsewhere in the world, for being a superfood. And it's full of protein, so it's more than 30% of protein, vegetal protein, and there is a kick on this at the moment. People want to eat less meat and more vegetable protein, vegan protein, and hemp is a great solution, because it's a very complete set of protein with all the acid hominid, and it also has the essential oil, the omega, the famous omega, omega 3 and omega 6. So it's a great food. It's easy to add to our daily meal. Just sprinkle it on the granola in the morning, or a soup or a salad. So at the moment, the major use for hemp in Canada is for food.
That's interesting, because historically we've talked about it being used for industrial purposes, and my understanding is that in Europe it is a lot of the fiber is being used for industry, but the Canadian industry hasn't come on board with that, right? That it is more food-based than it is sort of industrial construction-based for the uses of hemp. Is that right?
In the past two decades, like 98% of hemp cultivated in Canada was for seed only. But now it's interesting that farmers consider this other resource that they use to live in the field, the straw, the stalk, and they start to harvest it now, because there are some companies that are interested in buying it to transform the fiber, as we said, either for construction, or it can be used for mulch also, which is interesting in gardening, is interesting for animals, like animal bedding. So has a new part of the industry transforming the stalk. It's now a double crop. So it brings some more money to the farmer. And it's very interesting, because as there is a buzz around hemp, lately, there are more and more production worldwide in Asia, in the States, in Europe. So the prices that were quite high for the seeds for the farmers are getting lower and lower. So it's interesting that we now have a multi-use of the hemp crop, so that it brings more income to the farmers. And another way also in the development of this multi-use is the use of flowers, as we said. In the flowers, we can go get the CBD, which is the molecule of cannabidiol. And so this is another developing market at the moment in Canada that will for sure go very fast in the future.
So we've talked a lot about the benefits of hemp and the wonderful and various ways that it can be used. What's wrong with hemp? Like, what are the problems from a cultivation point of view, an industrialization point of view? What's the downside of it?
It's a very strong fiber, so it's great for to make rope, or to make very very strong clothing, for example, or to use in construction. But it's the stalk itself is quite hard to process in the machinery. So for farmers used to growing a corn or wheat, there is a challenge in getting into the cultivation of hemp because of for the harvest. Cultivating it is easy, but harvesting it is a bit more of a challenge. Also, when they harvest the seeds, it needs some care, because the seed is also very fatty. It's one of its advantages, but it needs to be harvested and kept properly, because otherwise the product can get bad. So new farmers have some difficulties sometimes. They need some support, some advice. Another challenge is the transformation of this talk, as we mentioned, because there was no industry, there was no market for this. So now there is a market that is developing, and there are plants that transform the stalk in Canada. So there is a new market for this. So it's interesting, but there is still a lot of processes that need to be refined, to be developed. For example, we didn't talk yet about plastic, but hemp is a great material to make plastics because of the cellulose that it has inside the stalk. But as the plant has been forbidden for decades, we didn't develop, you know, the technology leading to these products. So there are prototypes, there are businesses at the moment that are really worldwide working on developing plastics.
Now, sorry, when you say plastics, I just want to be clear, that are you talking about binding fiber of the hemp with polymers to produce a plastic, like to make a, I think there's a company in Scotland that makes glass frames out of that, for example. Or are you talking about a process that uses the oil within the hemp and uses that as you would like a petrochemical to create plastics from that?
The first one, biocomposite, yeah.
So the Scottish ones, they look sort of like wooden glasses almost. The fibers are embedded in a polymer, right?
Yeah. Exactly. There is there are already companies, for example, car companies using hemp for panels because hemp is very strong and lighter than their alternatives, and it's also renewable and all the ecological benefits. So there are already some uses, but there in the future, there will be much more uses for hemp plastics. Same thing for textile. At the moment, we can find clothes made out of hemp. Usually it's going to be a blend of hemp and cotton, but the hemp that is in these clothes comes from China because we have lost in North America and in Europe the ability to transform the hemp fibers into fabric.
Right. And you've been just in terms of advocacy for hemp and the various uses and the industrialization that needs to take place in Canada and elsewhere. You guys have been, the Hempassadors have been going on a bit of a bus road trip. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
We decided to go on a tour to meet hemp actors, to go collect information like photos, videos, interviews, and to share this with the general public, and also to go into, for example, markets or events and to have people taste hemp milk, hemp granola bar, and this kind of thing, because there is no better way to be consumed. That hemp is a great crop and hemp should be more in our industry. We toured Quebec, and in the coming years, we aim to tour all the whole provinces in Canada.
So where can people find out more about Hempassadors?
People can go check our website, which is ambassadors.ca, and we are also on Instagram and Facebook, and there is a lot of information about all the benefits of hemp on this platform.
Okay, well, thank you very much for sharing your information about hemp on this platform.
Thank you.
That was Hempassador Marie Eisenman, who spoke with me from Quebec. If you associate roasted chestnuts with Christmas, blame Mel Torme and Charles Dickens. The meaty, hearty nuts have become a staple of Christmas song and story, if not kitchens. Sydney Langford wants to change that, even though she had an explosive introduction to the hard little balls of nutty goodness. Here's her cautionary, though ultimately delicious, tale. Hey, Sydney, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Now, I think a lot of folks who listen to Patrick Stewart read the Christmas Carol or read it themselves are going to be familiar with the idea of roasted chestnuts, a chestnut roaster on a street corner in a foggy, cold London.
Oh,
certainly,
yeah.
Chestnuts roasting on the open fire in the story.
That's right. That's what I always think of.
But I think a lot of people are afraid of chestnuts. So can you talk to us a little bit about how to save yourself?
They are terrifying, and you know, they can be dangerous, as I found out. But you know what? I don't know. The folks across Canada, maybe in your town, you can still find the chestnut roaster on the street corner. I know that in Toronto, I'm in Port Hope, and I don't know that I've seen a chestnut roaster here, but I came from Toronto, and of course, at Christmas time, there was a big Christmas market, and they would have the roasted chestnuts, and the aroma is just so warm and rich and tasty, and it's such a treat. And I remember a few years back going into a fancy little restaurant, very hip little restaurant, one of those places on a little side street in Toronto where the chef had a lot of tattoos, you know. And we sat down, and he swaggered up to the bar and plunked a little amuse-bouche in front of my guest and I. And it was just a single roasted chestnut. And when I peeled it open, it was just such a revelation because it was sweet and tender, but kind of savory and a little bit meaty and smoky. Just a wonderful, wonderful thing. So I would say, even if you're frightened, feel the fear and do it anyway. Roast some chestnuts at least once in your life over an open fire. Absolutely the best way to go, because you're going to get that woodsy, smoky flavor that is part of the, and of course, just the experience of sitting around a fire, getting all bundled up, building a little fire outside in the snow, and doing it, that's kind of fun. Or over the fire in your living room or your den. That's also really fun. And you can buy these special roasters. They're baskets with a lid on the end of a long handle so that you're standing far back from the fire and you can shake your chestnuts over the flames and they stay contained in the basket. Because when dealing with chestnuts, containment is key. So after eating at this restaurant, I was very inspired to roast some chestnuts myself. So I went and, of course, starting now, whole chestnuts will be in the grocery stores almost everywhere. If you live near an Asian market, you can get whole chestnuts pretty well all year round. So this is the European chestnut, and you're going to bring it home. And I thought, okay, I'm going to roast these at home. And at the time, I didn't have a fireplace, so I'm going to do it in the oven. Pick through them. You're going to find some moldy ones pretty well always.
Almost always, yeah.
Yeah, right. Throw those away. You're going to find some shriveled ones that have, you know, just dried out to nothing. Throw those away. And when I mean throw them away, put them in the backyard. A squirrel will come along and take them. But then, here's what you need to do that I didn't do. Score the bottoms. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you what happened. I set the alarm. I went in the oven, and I went into the other room, and I was just minding my own business, and I started hearing these terrifying sizzling sounds and then bangs inside the oven. And I ran to see what was going on, and it was just terrifying. You know how that little knob on the top of the pressure cooker kind of rocks and sizzles?
Yeah.
Every chestnut was doing that, and the heat and the steam and the hot air was escaping out of the tiniest little fissures, and then they would blow, and there was chestnut meat everywhere, and the oven was caked with chestnuts. And when I panicked and I pulled the pan out, which I should not have done, I should have shut the oven door and gone out for a gin and tonic. But I pulled it out of the oven, and then, of course, they started flying around the kitchen. So I had to run for the hills. That was just an awful, awful failure. I did them again. This time, I did the scoring, and my gosh, were they delish.
They're wonderful.
Of course, yeah, they just, and the little X you make on the bone just kind of curls back like a lovely little, you know, open me here. And what's interesting is the chestnut itself makes a flour. So cooking with chestnut flour is something that the Europeans still do. French chestnuts, they make a flour as well that they make pancakes with, crepe. And Asians love chestnuts for their medicinal properties.
Well, thank you very much for sharing your adventures with the chestnut missiles. That was Harris Smith food editor Signe Langford, who no longer lives in fear of chestnuts. So, here we are at the end of this episode of Harris Smith Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please consider subscribing to this podcast on Apple, iTunes, or in your favorite podcast player. And please, tell your friends and family. Got feedback? We'd love to hear it. You can email us at letters@harrismithmag.com. That URL, harrismithmag.com, is also where you can order subscriptions online. And you can find Harris Smith Magazine on selected newsstands across Canada. Until next time, for Harris Smith Radio, I'm Wayne McPhail. And also, until next time, remember these four words: make, grow, sustain, share. Tune in for the next episode of Harris Smith Radio.